From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, Myanmar opens up, just a little, protests and elections in Egypt, and trying to sell football in China. Myanmar has been an international outcast for decades, run by a brutal military junta that has fueled ethnic conflict and cracked down on democracy activists, students, and even monks. But the new, nominally civilian president seems to be trying to change that dismal record. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spent 2 days in Myanmar this week, testing the government's commitment to reform, and NPR's Michelle Kellerman travelled with the secretary.
On her way to Myanmar, Secretary Clinton watched a film about Aung San Suu Kyi. Today, she was invited into Suu Kyi's lakeside home, a place that was also her prison for many years.
And the house looks wonderful. I had a little bit of a preview about how much work was done.
This thing, but you couldn't get around.
Secretary Clinton met Suu Kyi's doctor, her guards, and other staff, and says she knows how important it is to have dedicated people around. They strolled through Suu Kyi's garden, and then the Nobel laureate spoke about her hopes for democratic reforms in the country and a better relationship with the U.S.
If we go forward together, I am confident that there will be no turning back from the road towards democracy. We are not on that road yet, but we hope to get there as soon as possible with the help and understanding of our friends.
Aung San Suu Kyi has been advising the U.S. on what steps it could take to support President Thein Sein for the decisions he's made to ease censorship, improve election laws, and for his promises to try to promote peace efforts in the ethnic conflicts that have raged here for decades. Clinton was clearly moved by her visit to Suu Kyi's house and sat down with NPR to talk about her impressions.
It was an overwhelming personal experience for me because I've admired her for so long, and to see where she was unjustly imprisoned. She sacrificed so much, and now she has perhaps another chance to try to see the, you know, democracy that she's struggled for and sacrificed for come to reality.
She's now making this transition from democracy activist to politician running for elections. Have you given her some advice on you know, what politics is all about?
Oh, I think she certainly understands that it's a rough and tumble experience. But we did talk about the difficulties of, you know, not only standing for election, but being elected and having to make compromises. And that would be true in any political process. I mean, democracy really has to be constantly oiled by, you know, compromise. And a lot of people think that that somehow is less than principled. But people come into elective offices with many different experiences and ideologies, and you have to work together. She's fully aware of all of that. But I think it will still be something quite new and challenging for her.
Now you've met Thein Sein, the president. She seems to have confidence enough in him. But do you think he can deliver? I mean, he has a government that has a lot of people in it that don't like what he's doing.
We're going to be watching. I mean, that's our measurement, is what actually happens, not what is promised or not what is intended, but whether it's delivered. And we discussed at some length when I met with him about what the next steps needed to be. And, you know, releasing all political prisoners, setting a date for the elections and ensuring that they are free, fair, and credible, having a really comprehensive, well-designed effort to resolve the ethnic conflicts. Those are three very big steps that we think have to be taken before we can further engage on the range of issues that we'd be willing to discuss.
Secretary Clinton was speaking at a U.S. Embassy residence in Yangon. I'm Michelle Kellerman.
Coming up, protests and elections in Egypt and trying to sell football in China. Now to Egypt, where this week, days of protests gave way to 2 days of peaceful and well-attended elections. Now the protesters, who've been occupying Cairo's Tahrir Square, are wondering what their next steps should be. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro reports.
Last week, the protesters in Tahrir Square looked like they were about to topple yet another Egyptian government. There was a groundswell of support for their demand that the military council ruling Egypt step down and make way for civilian rule. For the past few days, though, Tahrir Square has been home mostly to the curious who come for a stroll or on dates. Hassan has been selling tea here since last January, at the beginning of Egypt's revolution. People are more fragmented, more divided, he says. People used to be more united, and now people are having arguments here all the time. He starts to cry, saying he feels many people are trying to drag down the spirit of the revolution. Many people are against Tahrir, he says. At least for now, it's not clear when or if there will be more mass protests in Tahrir.
Today, it does feel a bit low, and maybe this needs to pack up and save it for another time.
Omar Robert Hamilton is an Egyptian-British activist filmmaker.
The fact that the elections did go ahead, for all of their flaws and for the fact that everyone knows all the problems and limitations with them, I think has taken some of the energy out of the square.
Hamilton says the military council is using the elections to bolster its legitimacy in the aftermath of last week's violence. And it's working.
I do think that they are working very hard on trying to make it seem that Tahrir is something independent from the will of everyone else. And I think that's something that Tahrir has to work on, making people see that it's not a question of either being out and voting or being here, that everyone is actually pushing for the same thing, civilian rule and for, you know, genuine freedom.
Noor Noor is the activist son of opposition Egyptian politician and presidential candidate Ayman Noor. Even though Noor Noor was shot by the Egyptian security services with 2 rubber bullets in the recent unrest in Tahrir.
When the numbers in the sit-in are decreased, when the numbers are in a sit-in are very low, it's important to make the strategic decision to end the sit-in. This is not sustainable anymore.
Noor says one of the problems is that even though the protesters' demands are clear, an immediate end to military rule, there isn't a plan in place to really make it happen. Over the weekend, presidential contender Mohamed El-Baradei said he would head a national salvation government, but the idea was stillborn. So, says Noor, many activists think it may be better to bide their time.
You know, maybe it's not smart to keep this going because things are so ambiguous. Things are so are not really clear at the moment.
Mashira Ahmed is a founder of the April 6th movement, one of the earliest revolutionary protest groups. She says protests in Tahrir are not the only way they can exert pressure on the military junta. Activists are working in all sorts of areas, she says, monitoring the elections, standing for office, representing Egypt abroad. She says a lot of people have died on the square, died right next to us, left and right, and we cannot just abandon the square just like that, she says. We have to continue what we started. What these people died for, we have to make it happen. She says the square will continue to be a focal point. Even if the sit-in is called off for now, today's activists know their way back to Tahrir when it's needed. But Mashira Ahmed is about to get married, and so she's starting to think long-term about her children and their children. She says she hopes future Egyptians won't need to gather in Tahrir like her generation did. She says she dreams that her children will visit it as a site of historical interest, to see where people defied their government so they could be free. Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, NPR News, Cairo.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. Football is America's most lucrative professional sport, although selling the game overseas has never been easy. But the National Football League has been trying to make inroads in, of all places, China. NPR's Frank Langford reports from Shanghai.
It's a Sunday afternoon outside a soccer stadium in Shanghai, but it feels a lot like Middle America. Across the way here, you've got kids running the 40-yard dash. Right where I am, you have people running pass routes. And most everybody who's participating is Chinese. Inside, people are trying to throw passes to wooden cutouts of NFL players. Charles Ho is waiting his turn. He plays receiver on a flag football team at Shanghai University of Engineering and Science.
We love this sport very much. We like the feel of tackling. In primitive times, humans used their bare hands to kill their prey. Football awakes that potential in us.
Ho is wearing an Indianapolis Colts jersey, number 18, quarterback Peyton Manning. Ho's flag football team is one of more than 40 the NFL has set up here in recent years to spark interest. But Ho and flag football teammate Shadow Lee say the American pastime has yet to gain traction in the Middle Kingdom.
It's not very popular in China, but I think
it takes time.
Why do you think it's not popular?
Yes, equipment. It's very expensive. Yeah. We are students. We can't afford this.
Ho says football equipment here runs about $470 a person. That's a lot of money in China, even in relatively wealthy Shanghai. Football is much more physical than traditional Chinese sports like ping pong and badminton. And Lee says that frightens Chinese moms and dads.
Especially in China, you know, they are afraid their children will be hurt.
Yes, sir.
Yesterday was Zhu Jiaying's first experience with football, which is called ganlancho, or olive ball, in Chinese. Zhu, who works for a German auto company, said she found it exciting, but had no idea how to play it herself.
Get the ball is really difficult for me.
Hard to catch?
Yeah, it's really hard to catch it. It's not like the basketball, it's not round.
The reference to basketball is telling. Football has almost no history here, but basketball is wildly popular. Christian missionaries introduced it to China more than a century ago. Zhu played basketball in high school and follows the NBA. The NFL, that's a different story. Do you understand how football works?
No, sorry.
To help change that, the NFL staged a number of student football games yesterday. The late afternoon contest began with China's national anthem and a coin toss by NFL Hall of Famer and former Dallas Cowboy running back Tony Dorsett. Afterwards, Dorsett said to succeed, the NFL must keep teaching the game to as many Chinese kids as possible.
I think the real challenge is creating the awareness. You got to pound the pavement. When you don't understand anything, it's kind of hard to want it.
Yesterday's event was the first of its kind in China and drew more than 3,500 people. Most seemed to have a great time. But Shanghai has a population of 23 million, which suggests the NFL still has a lot of work ahead. Frank Langford, NPR News, Shanghai.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.